Nonna's own bones, as the china was made from bone and ash.
You clumsy girl!
Nedda smacked the little girl in the face, provoking a wail.
Do you know how much that dish cost? We could have eaten for weeks. Don't touch the plates.
Don't touch the plates,
Martina joined in, and the children raced into the dining room like a horde.
Look, a white cat,
a little boy howled, reaching for gnocchi, who sprang from the chair in alarm, then froze under the table, arching her back.
No, leave her alone.
Elisabetta dropped the broom and ran into the dining room.
There are two cats,
shouted one of the little girls, when she discovered Rico on the chair.
Two!
Catch them! Catch them!
A boy squealed, and the children swarmed after the cats. Rico scooted smartly to the stairwell, realizing that these dirty little humans were to be avoided at all costs.
Stop!
Elisabetta blocked the children's path as Rico and Gnocchi fled past them and up the stairs.
You must leave the cats alone. Cats! Two cats!
The children exploded in excited chatter.
One is white and one is striped.
Nedda, Martina, please, I have a request.
Elisabetta had to find a way to live with these people.
Please don't let the children tease the cats. They are accustomed to a quiet life.
Boof,
Nedda scoffed.
The children are playing.
Martina nodded.
They love cats. We used to have a cat. We ate it,
a little boy called out. Elisabetta recoiled, horrified.
You're kidding, aren't you?
The boy burst into laughter.
We loved it. It was delicious.
Nedda snorted.
Elisabetta, don't be so high and mighty. The bombs destroyed our farm. Our cow and goats were killed. Our husbands are in the army. I held my family together, and so did Martina. You don't have a family, so keep your snotty opinions to yourself.
Fine,
Elisabetta said, defensive. You keep the children away from the cats. No harm can come to these cats. They're mine and Nonna's. Nedda smirked.
She wasn't your Nonna.
She wasn't yours either. Sophia told me to expect one woman, a cousin.
Your last names are all different.
Watch your step,
Martina raised her voice.
We could have you thrown into the street. We'll tell Sophia.
Good luck, Elisabetta shot back. Sophia can't run the restaurant without me, so she'll never throw me out.
We'll see about that.
Do it. But don't let your children harm these cats.
Then get your ass upstairs. Stay out of our way, you bitch.
You stay out of mine.
Elisabetta headed for the stairs, upset.
And you can't use the kitchen anymore. You're not allowed.
I eat at the restaurant anyway.
Elisabetta ran upstairs and locked her bedroom door, resolving that the cats would never go downstairs again. From now on, she would feed them and move their litter box to her room. She sat down on the bed, petting them and trying to calm down. All three listened to the clamor coming from downstairs. Suddenly, she remembered that there was a storage closet on the second floor where Nonna kept her soup tureens that were too large for the brake fronts. Elisabetta couldn't allow them to be sold off, too. She left the bedroom and hurried to the storage closet. She retrieved a tureen and carried it back to her bedroom, then returned to the storage closet again and again until she had moved all of the tureens to safety. When she was finished, she locked the bedroom door behind her and counted the beautiful tureens, which covered the floor. There were 34, each with its matching lid and ladle. She scanned them with a loving eye, remembering how Nonna had shown her each one, educating her about its vintage and manufacturer. There was the ornate Capodimonte tureen, from an Italian manufacturer, with pink and yellow flowers and handles shaped like swan's necks. An older Majolica tureen with bright orange and green flowers, with fluted ridges in the bowl. A Haviland Limoges tureen, with pink flowers and gold-rimmed accents on the rim, handles, and pedestal. Nonna's favorite was an authentic Minton of the Rococo Revival period. A rare pattern of blue and white flowers, its elegantly fluted lid filigreed with gold.
Okay, let's go,
Elisabetta said to the cats. She picked up one of the tureens and went to the small door on the far side of her bedroom, which led to a fire escape. It was on the back of the house and went to the rooftop, where she had a potted garden with herbs for the restaurant. The only access was through Elisabetta's room, so nobody could go there but her and the cats. Rico and Gnocchi loved their private sanctuary, and they walked up, their tails as straight as exclamation marks. Elisabetta reached the rooftop and set the tureen down among the pots, then went back downstairs, retrieved another tureen, and brought it up. She worked until all of the tureens were on the rooftop, and when she finally finished, she exhaled with relief. The garden would be even more beautiful, because now it would feature Nonna's tureens, planted in her memory. Elisabetta felt her gaze travel upward into the dome of night sky, shaped like the underside of a tureen lid. She knew that Nonna was looking down on her, and Nonna understood that there was nothing more that Elisabetta could have done except for rescuing 34 soup tureens and 2 cats.
Chapter 67. Sandro, January 1942. Sandro stood outside the modest apartment house on a residential back street in Ostiense in southwest Rome. Professor Tullio Levi-Civita had died in the house just a few days ago. The professor had been 68 years old, and a heart attack had taken his life. These days Sandro rarely left the ghetto, but he had come after reading the death notice in the newspaper, published without any fanfare. Levi-Civita had received none of the memorials he deserved, the little man who was a giant in his field. Sandro wondered if anyone would ever even know of Levi-Civita, or if the fascists would succeed in erasing him from history altogether. An older woman dressed in fashionable clothes walked by, and when she glanced over, Sandro saw himself through her eyes. A thin young man with sunken cheeks, a worn muffler, and shabby clothes. He wondered if she could tell he was Jewish, for he felt his Jewishness now more than he ever had before, a paradoxical effect of the race laws. It was a cold day, and Sandro wrapped his muffler closer, eyeing the house. He had followed Levi-Civita's career, or what had been left of it, after the professors had been expelled. Levi-Civita hadn't been permitted to teach anywhere, but Pope Pius XII had invited him to broadcast on the Vatican radio station regarding new developments in science. Levi-Civita had become the first Jew ever to do so, but Sandro hadn't been able to listen because he had been teaching. He was paying his respects now, as best as he could, a lone mourner. He felt the loss of the professor for himself and for the country they loved. No one would ever know what other groundbreaking advances Levi-Civita would have made had he been allowed to continue working, teaching, and publishing papers. No one could ever say which students Levi-Civita would have mentored, who would have brought advances to follow, as science builds on itself like bricks in a wall. Sandro had hoped to be among those students, but that time had passed. He thought of the other professors expelled from the University of Rome, as if he were walking through a cemetery, reading tombstones. There was Enrico Fermi, who had won the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1938. His wife Laura had been Jewish, so he had emigrated. There was Leo Pincherle, the grandson of the mathematician Salvatore Pincherle, who founded functional analysis in Italy, Federico Enriquez, Bruno Rossi, Emilio Segre, Sergio De Benedetti, Ugo Fano, Eugenio Fubini, Bruno Pontecorvo, Giulio Racca, Franco Rasetti, and so many others at the other departments at the universities of Rome, as well as Turin, Bologna, Pavia, Padua, Trieste, and Milan. Sandro wondered if he ever would have accomplished something as brilliant as Tullio Levicivita. He doubted it, but he knew for sure that he would have tried. He had wanted to try, from when he was young, from as far back as when Professoressa Longhi had told him about the independent study. He would never forget the day he got the note from Levicivita himself. Sandro looked at the house one last time. There was a low wall of grey stucco in front, with pillars that flanked an iron gate to its entrance. He walked to the gate with his bicycle, said a silent prayer, and took a small rock from his pocket, then set it on the pillar. A loving remembrance from one Jewish mathematician to another.
Chapter 68. Elisabetta, May 1943. Elisabetta counted the money and ration cards from the dinner service, pleased that they had broken even again, a success in these difficult days. Food shortages were decimating the restaurant business, but she kept Casa Servano going by making the pasta herself, hiring only a waitress, and getting occasional help from Sofia. Sugar and coffee were impossible to stock, but she made ersatz coffee from chicory and stretched the flour by adding chaff and ground potato peels. She brought in fresh herbs from her rooftop garden, which continued to be a haven for her and the cats, safe from Nedda, Martina, and the children. Sofia entered the kitchen, taking off her apron. She was a pretty woman, but she had aged since Paolo had gone to war. Her brown eyes looked tired, tilting down at the corners, and gray strands threaded her dark hair. "I'm finished in the dining room. I have to get home." "Good news. We made as much as last night." Elisabetta stuffed the lire into a canvas pouch and handed it to her. "Thanks." Sofia reached for her purse and put the money pouch inside, exhaling. "How I loathe our Nazi customers. Every day there's more of them. They treat me like dirt." "But the joke's on them, since we take their money." Elisabetta hated the Nazis too, so she had raised prices. Top Nazi brass had become regulars. Even the German ambassador to the Vatican, Baron Ernst von Weizsäcker. "I know there are allies, but it was a bad marriage from the outset." Sofia frowned. "Meanwhile, Paolo's letters grow worse. He says it's a lost cause. I pray every night that the war ends soon. I don't even care if we lose." "I feel the same way. I think we're getting close to the end, no matter the propaganda in the newspapers." Elisabetta sensed that the tide was turning against the fascists, after defeats in Stalingrad and Tunisia. Everyone was whispering that Mussolini had led the country astray. She wondered if Marco's loyalty to fascism had wavered, but she dismissed thoughts of him. She never did figure out how her father's hands had gotten broken. "I worry about Paolo all the time. I'm sure." Elisabetta worried about Sandro all the time, too. The race laws had ground the Jews of Rome into oppression, and she could only imagine how Sandro and his family were faring. She used to walk through the ghetto, hoping to catch sight of him, but she had stopped. Still, she never stopped loving him. The fascists couldn't police her heart. "The children miss their father. I leave the radio off or they ask too many questions." "I'm sorry." Elisabetta gave her a brief hug. "If it makes you feel better, I spit in the pasta we serve the Nazis." "You do," Sophia burst into surprised laughter.
Nonna taught me. I learned from the best.
That you did.
Sophia's expression softened.
I miss her too.
We go on for her,
Elisabetta said, patting her back.
Good night.
Good night.
Sophia left, and Elisabetta experienced a pang of mourning. She looked around the kitchen, letting her gaze linger on the pantry that had been Nonna's throne room. She found herself entering the pantry, running her fingertips along the wooden surface of the table, then using her fingernail to clean out the flour wedged into its grain. She felt as if she were touching Nonna herself. And so they remained together, in life and in death. Elisabetta heard a noise behind her.
Sophia, did you forget something?
She asked, turning around. But it wasn't Sophia. Standing in the kitchen was a large, dark-haired man. She experienced a tingle of fear, realizing she had forgotten to lock the front door after closing. Crime was rampant in Rome these days. But the man didn't look malicious. He was as thin as a rolling pin, and his shabby jacket and pants hung on him.
Sir, please go,
Elisabetta said just the same.
Please, if you have any food to spare, I would thank you.
My wife was killed when our farm was bombed, and I have nothing. I served in the army until I injured my foot.
I'm sorry, but I have nothing to spare, and a restaurant to run.
I'm not asking for myself, but for my children. 2 boys and a girl, my youngest. They won't eat much, I promise. If you could feed them, just this once, I would never bother you again.
The man gestured to the dining room.
They're outside, skin and bones. If you don't believe me, see for yourself.
Of course I believe you,
Elisabetta said, giving in.
Please, sir, go sit down. I'll make you off some pasta.
She didn't need to see the children. She already knew how they would look.
Chapter 69. Marco. June 1943. Marco fell into step with his friend Rolf, and they walked along the Tiber on the Lungotevere di San Gallo. Marco had been working around the clock at Palazzo Venezia, and he needed a break on such a nice day. The sun climbed high in a bright blue sky, and he always felt restored by the river, a natural oasis from noise, traffic, and worry. Tall palm trees lined the stone wall, which was set high above the riverbank. A damp, familiar breeze blew off the water, rustling their fronds. He breathed in a fresh lungful, and Rolf sipped from his silver flask. The Nazi's dimpled cheeks had a boyishness that women loved, though his fondness for beer gave him a belly that strained the buttons of his uniform. Otherwise, Rolf had an athletic frame, having been a stellar soccer player in his hometown of Osnabrück in northern Germany.
You're quiet, Marco, Rolf said in German.
He looked over, his narrow brown eyes shifting under the black patent bill of his cap. His lips, which were thin, formed a flat line, uncharacteristically so.
I'm tired, Marco answered, also in German.
Rolf had taught him the language, and he had become fluent. But when he was tired, it felt effortful.
Do you mind if we speak Italian?
Not at all, Rolf answered, switching languages easily. He spoke Italian like a native, thanks to Marco.
My boss is driving me crazy. I really needed to get out today.
Here. Rolf offered his flask to Marco, who shook his head no.
My boss would smell it on my breath. He stands so close when he talks, I smell his garlic. Mine would never know.
Rolf capped the flask.
Germans don't stand as close as Italians.
Genau, Rolf said, which meant exactly, a word that Germans used as often as Italians used allora. He looked around with a smile.
This is such a beautiful city. It was better before, Marco heard himself say, though he hadn't realized he felt that way. How so? Marco fell silent, having seen so many changes in Rome since Italy had entered the war. The city functioned, and stores remained open, but the lines for food and other necessities were endless, and Romans looked harried, their faces showing the strain. Everyone's clothes were worn, and the military presence dominated the sidewalks and streets, with uniformed personnel and vehicles everywhere. He missed the carefree pretty girls, walking this way and that, the lovers kissing at a cafe, and the noisy school children with gelato dripping over their fingers. Rome used to have brio, a life and spirit unique to this remarkable city, but it was gone. Marco? Rolf asked, puzzled. It's just different, that's all. Well, I love it here. When the war is over, I think I may move here, like von Weizsäcker. He loves Rome. Marco knew he meant Baron Ernst von Weizsäcker, the German ambassador to the Vatican, who came to Palazzo Venezia from time to time. Weizsäcker genuinely liked Italians, in contrast to the Nazi brass, who carried themselves with an undisguised air of superiority. The entry of the United States into the war had gotten their attention, but the Nazis remained confident of victory. My boss is happy that things are going so well for us.
Are they?
Marco thought of his father, who was turning out to be right about one thing. There was a difference in the way you viewed the war, depending on whether you were German or Italian. The Allied bombing is destroying southern Italy and Sicily. The Allies won't let up. They're targeting the south because it supports the North African front. Whatever the reason, it's devastating to us. Marco realized Rolf didn't feel the same sympathy, because Italy wasn't his country. Look on the bright side. They haven't bombed major cities like Rome, Venice, and Florence. I doubt they will. But they bombed Genoa, and it's a major city. Besides, my boss said it's not only the targets the Allies are choosing, but the way they're bombing. They're flying more missions, dropping a greater volume of smaller bombs. Marco had overheard a phone conversation the other day. It's a brutal, relentless campaign. There's no food and no shelter. Italians are terrified. They didn't expect any of this. They feel betrayed. They're losing heart and belief in the war. Marco heard himself saying, they. But he was Italian, so it should have been we. The Allies are trying to get Italy to drop out in order to weaken the Axis. They think Italy is the weak link.
We're not,
Marco shot back, defensive. So then it won't work. Italy won't quit.
Of course not, Marco said.
But he wasn't certain. He had sensed a new tension in the air at Palazzo Venezia, and an undercurrent of blame that led to all manner of backstabbing and second-guessing. His boss griped privately that Italy had entered the war unprepared, and that Il Duce spent afternoons in his private bedroom with women, words that never would have been uttered before. Marco was beginning to question the most fundamental of fascist precepts. Maybe Mussolini wasn't always right.
Let's stop a minute.
Rolf took off his hat and rested it on the wall. He wiped sweat from his brow, making his short brown hair stick up. Marco stood looking out at the Tiber, watching the moving current of the water. He loved its cloudy jade color and the little white caps of foam. He remembered those lazy, carefree days on the riverbank with Elisabetta, Sandro, and his classmates. It hurt his heart to think of it now.
What are you looking at?
Nothing, Marco shrugged. I used to do bike tricks on the riverbank to impress a girl.
Did you get her?
Marco thought that one over.
No.
Impossible to believe.
Rolf took out his pack of cigarettes and plugged one between his lips.
What happened?
It doesn't matter now.
Marco wanted to keep Elisabetta in his past.
Her loss, eh?
Marco didn't reply. Elisabetta was his loss forever.
His heartbroken gaze returned to the Tiber. Then he spotted a group of men shoveling sand on the embankment downriver. The men were naked to the waist, and some had bandanas on their heads as protection from the sun. One wore a hat made of folded newspaper. Marco flashed on a memory. Elisabetta had worn a hat like that by the river once. He found himself walking along the wall to get a closer look at the man.
Where are you going?
Rolf lit his cigarette behind a cupped hand.
I want to see what they're doing below.
Marco stopped when he got close enough. The man in the paper hat had gotten so much thinner. But Marco would have recognized him anywhere. It was Sandro. Marco felt stricken. He had known that a race law compelled ghetto Jews into forced labor, but he hadn't focused on it before. It horrified him to think that his old friend, who was a bona fide genius, was digging like a common laborer. His heart ached with the love he had had for Sandro, which must have lain dormant until now. Suddenly, Sandro lifted his face and looked up at Marco, holding his gaze. Marco's mouth went dry, and in that moment he saw himself as Sandro saw him, a witness to his own actions, a fascist standing with a Nazi. And Marco didn't recognize himself. Sandro resumed digging, but Marco experienced an epiphany. He didn't know who he was anymore. He didn't know what he had become. He had performed so well at Palazzo Venezia this past year, a rising star. But his father had been right about that, too. There were bosses on top of bosses, like a ladder that never ended. Marco didn't know why he was climbing it anymore. He didn't even know where it led. He felt embittered with shame for all that he had said and done, for all he had become. He had once told Sandro that he wasn't his uniform. But he had been wrong. He had become his uniform. And now he was disgusted with himself.
Marco, do you know one of those guys?
Marco blinked, shaken.
Yes, the one in the paper hat.
Who is he?
Rolf blew out a cone of cigarette smoke.
My best friend.
Rolf frowned.
Your best friend was a Jew?
Yes. Marco averted his eyes.
Let's go.
Where? Back to work?
I don't know, Marco answered.
Lost.
Chapter 70. Elisabetta, 19th of July, 1943. Elisabetta walked along, heading for San Lorenzo to meet a new black market connection. San Lorenzo was a more congested neighborhood than Trastevere, and businessmen hurried on crowded sidewalks. Mothers tugged children by the hand, and old women rolled shopping carts behind them. Cars and buses and trams honked on the wide streets. She turned onto Via Cesare de Lollis, bordering La Sapienza, which reminded her of Sandro. It seemed like ages ago that she had gone with him to the Delada lecture. Back then, all she had to worry about was choosing between two wonderful men. Suddenly, an air raid siren erupted through the loudspeakers on the street. She heard a horrifying hum vibrating through the air. She looked up in fear, and so did everyone else. A fleet of American bombers blanketed the sky, aiming directly for San Lorenzo. The flying fortresses. She knew from photos in the newspaper. Chaos erupted. Women shrieked in terror, men shouted, everyone raced to get off the street. The air sirens screamed. The planes zoomed toward them. Their engines rumbled louder and louder, a fearsome roar. Elisabetta whirled around, not knowing if there was a shelter. Men and women jostled her, scattering in all directions. She raced with the panicked crowd to the nearest building, a shoe store. People pushed and shoved to get inside, frantic and desperate. She pressed in with them, obeying instincts for survival. The roar of the planes deafened her. Everyone covered their ears, screaming, shouting, praying, crying. Mothers clutched their children, cowering. The planes darkened the sky and eclipsed the sun. Boom! A blinding flash of light exploded in the middle of the street. The percussive blast sent her flying through the air. Brick and stones spewed as if from a volcano. She landed on the ground with everybody else, a stunned mass of humanity, wailing, crying, screaming, groaning, bleeding. Elisabetta stayed conscious. Her head pounded. She couldn't hear a thing. It was as if she had gone deaf. She told herself she had to get moving. She had to find shelter. She tried to get up, but a woman lay on top of her, motionless. Elisabetta tried calling to her, but the woman didn't respond. Elisabetta realized the woman was dead. A little girl lay moving nearby, her head bloodied. There was another explosion, then another. The ground shuddered. Black smoke billowed. The roof of the shop buckled and crashed. Elisabetta screamed in sheer terror. She still couldn't hear herself. She struggled to her feet. Grit and debris blanketed her body. Cuts covered her arms and legs. Her purse was gone. She was missing a shoe. Boom, boom, boom. Bombs exploded throughout the neighborhood. The explosions rocked the ground. Debris flew everywhere. Glass windows blew out of storefronts. Elisabetta couldn't see through the smoke. Fires broke out on the buildings, flashes of horrifying orange amid wreckage. The air superheated. Black smoke rolled across the rubble, heavy with particulate. Her eyes stung, her nostrils clogged. She coughed, gasping. People staggered like shadows in an inferno. The explosions kept coming. She ran this way, then that, colliding into terrified people doing the same. Everyone fled, screaming. She whirled around, losing any sense of direction. She heard crying and realized it was coming from her. Her knees buckled. She fell to the ground atop the rubble and lost consciousness. Elisabetta looked up, blinking, trying to gather her senses. Her head pounded, her entire body ached. She lay backward on broken concrete, facing up. The sky was barely visible through the smoke. Her brain struggled to function. The American bombers had gone. The attack was over. She had no idea how long she had been lying here. She could hear faint wailing. She tried to move. It hurt, but her legs and arms weren't broken. She sat up slowly, feeling her face. Warm blood wet her hands. Her arms and legs were gashed. Gray soot covered her clothes and body. She couldn't breathe. Her nostrils were full. She snorted black snot. Her mouth tasted gritty and dirty. She staggered to her feet, looking around in horror. San Lorenzo had been leveled. She could see through to the next street. Fires flared and burned in the rubble and ruins. People and authorities were trying to put out the flames. Shops had been reduced to piles of brick, marble, stone, and twisted metal. Carnage surrounded her. Severed limbs lay in the street like so much meat. Men, women, and children lay dead among the debris and rubble, bleeding from gruesome wounds. Hospital personnel and authorities ran back and forth with stretchers and black medical bags. Blood was spattered everywhere. Everyone's clothes were soaked and stained, torn and shredded. Some people were still alive, moaning and crying, writhing in agony from mortal wounds. Among them was the detritus of human life. A spiral-bound notebook, a brown purse, horn-rimmed eyeglasses, a briefcase. The woman next to her lay motionless, her gaze fixed heavenward. A little boy lay next to the woman. Blood matted his hair, tears dried in rivulets in the grime on his face. His lips moved, and Elisabetta realized he was alive. She staggered to his side, kneeling down. "Are you okay?" she asked. And the little boy's eyes fluttered open, a bloodshot dark brown. His mouth formed words she couldn't hear. He raised his arms weakly, melting her heart, and she scooped him up. "Mama," the little boy whispered hoarsely. "Okay, okay." Elisabetta scanned his little body for injuries. There were cuts all over him. She spotted a jagged shard of glass in his thigh. Blood leaked from the wound, flowing steadily down his leg. "Help!" Elisabetta called out, hoarse. The medical personnel didn't come. Everyone alive was screaming for help. She started to remove the shard, but stopped herself. Instinctively, she knew it should stay in place. It was plugging the vein. She had to stop the bleeding. He could bleed to death.
"Mama, mama, mama,"
the little boy whispered over and over.
"I'm here,"
Elisabetta said, frantic. She held the boy in one arm and clawed at her shirt with the other, ripping off her sleeve. She rested the boy on her lap, using both hands to twist the sleeve and tied it quickly around his thigh, making a tourniquet above the shard of glass.
"Mama,"
the little boy whispered, his eyes rolling back in his head. He must have been going into shock. Elisabetta yelled for help again, but the medical personnel were busy. She remembered the hospital wasn't far. She could get him there. She gathered him in her arms, struggled to her feet, and started making her way. The boy went limp, and his lips kept forming the word "mama" over and over.
"Help!"
Elisabetta called out, stumbling through the rubble. Electrical wires sparked. Wood burned and smoldered around her. Gray smoke obscured the way. She tripped and almost fell. She held the little boy to her chest. His legs dangled, his feet were bare. Blood dripped from his thigh wound, but less than before. Her tourniquet was working. She kept going, calling for help. There was no path, no street. She passed mangled bodies amid the debris of buildings, collapsed walls, and crushed cars. Moaning and screaming emanated from piles of rubble, where people had been buried alive. She saw a crowd collecting at the end of the street. It looked as if there were authorities there, too. She headed in that direction and kept going. The crowd was shouting at something she couldn't see. She was almost there.
"Mama,"
the little boy whispered, and all of a sudden his body went limp in her arms. Elisabetta looked down in fear. His head drooped over her arms, his neck stretched. She kept going, holding him tighter. Tears spilled from her eyes.
"Help, please,"
Elisabetta wailed, and heads turned in the back of the crowd. The faces were grimy and bloodied, their expressions dazed and deranged.
"The king is here," shouted a man.
"What king?"
Elisabetta asked, feeling as if she were walking in a nightmare. The little boy sagged in her arms, lifeless.
"The king of Italy, Vittorio Emanuele. The pope was here an hour ago."
Elisabetta craned her neck. She caught a glimpse of uniformed Republican guards and fascists, forming a protective escort for the gray-bearded King Vittorio Emanuele III. It was bizarre, a king amid the hellish scene, resplendent in his uniform with its shiny brass buttons, fancy ribbons, and gold-braided epaulettes. His elegant wife was in their gleaming black limousine, and a uniformed aide was giving money to the crowd.
"Keep your money, you bastard!"
The crowd threw it back, jeering and spitting.
"We want peace. You're no good,"
a woman yelled at the king. Look what you've done to Italy.
It's your fault, another man hurled rubble at the limousine. You got my wife and daughter killed. Their blood is on your hands.
You betrayed us, an old woman screamed. You ruined us.
Down with the king, down with Mussolini. The crowd began throwing rocks, turning violent. Elisabetta edged away in fear and grief. She sank to her knees on the hard rubble, holding the boy to her chest. It was all too horrific. War and death, kings and popes, bombs, Nonna, the boy. She couldn't take it anymore. She felt as if she were losing her mind. Tears streamed down her cheeks. She kissed the boy's sweet face and told him that his mother loved him very much. And she stayed with him until a nurse came and took them both away.
Chapter 71. Marco, 25th of July, 1943. Marco was on the second floor of Palazzo Venezia, standing with a grim crowd of fascist officers. In the early morning hours, the Grand Council had voted a motion of no confidence in Mussolini, and Il Duce was being escorted to the grand marble staircase. Many said it was the end for Mussolini, and that King Vittorio Emanuele III would be taking command of the armed forces. Italians hoped that the war would be over for Italy. Outside on Piazza Venezia, thousands were celebrating. Marco watched, reeling, as Mussolini passed him. Il Duce looked haggard in a rumpled blue suit, and there was no trace of the powerful, magnetic man who had shaken his hand that night and run the country for over 20 years. Italy had taken major blows with the Allied invasion of Sicily and the bombing of San Lorenzo. More than 2,000 people had been killed, and thousands more injured in the bombardment, which had lasted over 2 hours. The Allies had sent some 900 bombers over the railway in San Lorenzo and Littorio, and 2 air bases at Ciampino. One of the B-17s had reportedly been piloted by American actor Clark Gable. Marco heard the shouting surge outside, which told him that Mussolini's car had left Palazzo Venezia. The shouting went on and on, no longer the chanted Duce, 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 but hooting, hollering, and incomprehensible cursing. Everyone blamed Mussolini for leading the country into war. Marco descended the marble stairs, ignoring the officers rushing this way and that. They would attempt an impossibly Herculean task, that of writing a national government. It was rumored that the king was about to appoint Marshal Badoglio as the new prime minister. But Marco had grown up hearing his father curse Badoglio. Badoglio was a weak career officer, responsible for the humiliating defeat at Caporetto in the Great War. Badoglio was supposed to negotiate the terms of Italy's surrender, without provoking Nazi retaliation or drawing the anger of the Allies. No one at Palazzo Venezia believed Badoglio could do the job. Marco put it all behind him, walking slowly down the steps. He wasn't working today. He didn't know about tomorrow. He had been so wrong to believe in Mussolini. He was appalled that he had supported the war, which had caused death, starvation, and destruction. Vast regions of his homeland lay in rubble. Turin, Milan, Bologna, Palermo, Messina, Brescia, Catania, Naples had been bombed. 500,000 Italians were dead. Marco left Palazzo Venezia, astounded at the jubilant, chaotic, and drunken crowd packing the piazza, ablaze with sun. Men, women, and children danced, waved flags and banners, sang, held up posters of the king, and played trumpets and horns. He wedged his way between them, exhausted. Confetti fluttered through the air, and wine bottles were hoisted high. Men climbed ladders against the buildings and chiseled off fascist emblems. Posters of Mussolini were ripped from kiosks. A plaster bust of Il Duce flew from a window and crashed onto the street, to gales of drunken laughter. A truck careened recklessly past, its bed full of cheering men, flying Italian flags and banners of the king. Marco made his way through the mob. A woman kissed him, and another one gave him a bottle of wine, which he drank thirstily. He finally reached the end of the piazza, hoping to leave the crowd behind him. But more people flooded the streets from every direction. He couldn't share their joy, for they celebrated husbands and sons coming home. But he could only think of those who wouldn't. He didn't know what his fellow Italians had died for. Everyone had believed in the same tragic delusion. Not Aldo. Tears flooded his eyes. Marco realized that he would never see Aldo again. Never ride with him. Never tease him at dinner. He had kept his love for his brother locked inside, with his love for Elisabetta and Sandro. And there was so much love locked away in him, too much. His heart simply didn't have the chambers to hold it, and it couldn't be contained anymore. He hurled his wine bottle at a building, which shattered into flying glass. A woman laughed raucously, and Marco kept going, making his way through the riotous crowd, staggering more than walking. He reached the Ponte Fabricio, traveled up and then down the footbridge, spotting his father in front of Bar Girosport, wearing his long apron and organizing an unruly crowd outside the restaurant. Marco had never been so happy to see his father, which gave him a deep pang of guilt. They had hardly spoken to each other in so long, but he let his legs carry him down the hill, like a car running out of fuel.
Papa,
Marco called, and his father's head turned instantly, looking at him with an expression that mirrored his own love, anguish, and regret. His father ran to meet him and scooped him up in his strong arms, embracing him as if he were a little boy again. And Marco buried his face in his father's big, warm, sweaty neck, beginning to cry. I know, son, his father said quietly. I know. Chapter 72. Sandro, 26th of July, 1943. Sandro scanned the happy scene in front of the house, and the amazing news had drawn everyone into the street to celebrate. Mussolini was on his way out, and it appeared that Italy would exit the war. Ghetto Jews could see the end of their long, horrible ordeal. The Simone family sat among their neighbors, who were singing, laughing, and hugging each other at tables set up for an impromptu party. Their street was too narrow to enjoy full sun, but a sliver of brightness was all they needed. There was no food to spare, but they shared. There was no wine or real coffee, but they made do with water and whatever else they had. They had suffered for 5 years, stripped of their citizenship, professions, jobs, homes, and savings. They had been brought to the brink of starvation, suffering sickness and deprivation. They had been denied justice and all of their rights. But they had persevered to see this glorious day.
To Italy, Sandro said, raising his glass of water. To Italy.
His father, mother, and Rosa raised their glasses. Sandro sipped his water. He could only imagine the emotions his sister was feeling. She would be worried about David, as she hadn't had news of him since he had entered the special operations group. Italy might have dropped out of the war, but had raged on for Britain and the Allies against Germany and Japan. Sandro touched her hand. Rosa, I know David will be home soon.
I agree,
Rosa smiled back gamely.
The end is in sight now. Yes, it is, darling,
their mother said, putting her arm around her.
It has to be.
Their father's eyes danced behind his glasses.
I hope the race laws will be repealed as the first order of business. The community has already dispatched an emissary to the Badoglio government.
I would love to go back to school.
Sandro brightened, expecting that the Jewish faculty would return to La Sapienza, even if Levi Civita hadn't lived to see this day.
I can go back to the hospital, his mother said. delight etched into her weary features. His father grinned.
I can re-establish my practice.
Sandro leaned forward. So, Papa, how long will it take to negotiate the armistice?
I don't know for sure. It's a tricky business. Badoglio is in charge, so it will be poorly executed. If he drags his feet, the Allies will teach him a lesson.
Their mother nodded. Let's hope it comes quickly. Sandro's thoughts strayed to Marco. Back to the day he had been digging sand on the riverbank and had looked up to see Marco with a Nazi. The sight had horrified him. But he knew his best friend was still in there, somewhere under the fascist uniform. They would probably never again be close, since Marco suspected that he had been seeing Elisabetta behind his back. Sandro's heart wrenched at the thought of her. He remembered when she had confessed her love to him at school. By now she'd probably met another man, maybe even married. Elisabetta would never become his wife, but his heart would always belong to her.
To a brighter future,
his father said, raising his glass. Chapter 73. Marco, August 1943. It was almost midnight, but Marco was walking home exhausted. He had returned to work at Palazzo Venezia, but he was already regretting his decision. The Badoglio government had yet to find its footing, and still hadn't signed the armistice. The feckless Badoglio delayed in choosing between the Germans and the Allies, trying to get Rome declared an open city or neutral zone. Both sides were losing patience with Italy. The Germans had withdrawn to the outskirts of Rome, under Field Marshal Kesselring, and the Allies had dropped leaflets on the city warning that they would resume bombing if Badoglio didn't sign. Marco walked down the Ponte Fabricio, unable to shake his melancholy. He still didn't know who he was anymore. He didn't know what to believe in. Fascism had been his identity for so long, he didn't have another alternative. The Badoglio government wasn't offering any. He had passed a happy family on the bridge, and he wondered if he would ever have a wife and children. He slept with women, but his state of mind grew darker. He still thought of Elisabetta and would walk by her restaurant. He loved her, but he knew that she loved Sandro. Even if she wasn't with Sandro, she was lost to Marco. He crossed the bridge and spotted his father closing the outside seating area. When he reached the bar, he said, Papa, I'll get an apron and help you clean up.
It's done. Get us some wine and meet me inside.
Marco went inside, poured them both a glass of red, and took it to a table near the side entrance. He sat down and sipped his wine, but it didn't improve his mood. His father entered, locked the door, and walked over, sitting down heavily.
Marco, what's the matter?
Palazzo Venezia. The officers and the politicians. Badoglio's an idiot, like you said. His father took a slug of wine.
So why don't you quit? Work for me.
Marco didn't want to fight. They were only recently getting along better. Papa, I mean no disrespect, but I don't want to work at the bar for my life. It's your business, not mine.
Then what do you want to do?
If I say I don't know, you'll be disappointed. I know I'm not living up to your expectations. I barely ride anymore. I work for Palazzo Venezia. They changed my title, but it's the same job. And I can barely read, Marco thought, but didn't say.
So? You're not your job, son. Life rarely meets our expectations. Do you think I've met mine? Did Mussolini meet ours?
His father shook his head, his face falling.
I made a terrible mistake.
I made the same mistake.
But I should have known better. You were taught to follow Mussolini. But I chose to. I ask myself why, over and over. I think I know now.
Why?
Years ago, the unification tried to make us into one Italy. But we didn't know what that meant. We had no single national identity.
His father met his eye, pained. Italy had to figure out
who she was, and Mussolini told her that she was the greatness that produced Rome. He might have been right, but he lost his way.
Marco felt the words resonate. He had been trying to figure out who he was, too. He had lost his way, like the land he loved.
Mussolini is a bully, and I'll regret joining his party as long as I live. I had my doubts when he pushed the race laws, but I went along. So many people suffered. Poor Massimo.
How is he?
Marco knew his father still sneaked the Simone's food and money. He's praying for Badoglio to lift the race laws.
And Sandro, how's he?
He's okay. His father paused. So in my view, we've made mistakes, but we have an opportunity to set it right. You know what I always say. Not every battle is worth fighting, but some are. We have one now, for Italy.
I agree. That's what I tell people at work, but they don't listen.
They're politicians. You know who's not politicians?
Who?
The Nazis.
His father sipped his wine.
The Nazis aren't going to let Rome go. This city is the prize. The birthplace of Western civilization. The home of the Vatican. The eternal city. Kesselring is an Italophile. He wants to own Rome, possess her. He will try to take her sooner rather than later.
Marco heard an edge in his father's words. What are you saying?
I formed a group, mostly veterans of the Great War. That's where I go at night, when I say I have vendor meetings.
What do you do? Marco asked, astonished.
Acts of sabotage.
Marco's mouth dropped open. You're an anti-fascist?
Yes. In our own cell, a network of partisans. Many other networks are forming. The Fronte Militare Clandestino della Resistenza under Montezemolo. The Comitato di Liberazione Nazionale. There's a power vacuum in Palazzo Venezia. Politicians and officers offer talk. We defend the city.
Marco felt his pulse quicken. How long has this been going on?
Months. Does Mamma know?
No.
Better for her if she doesn't.
Why didn't you tell me?
You weren't ready. Now you are. I could tell by the way you walked down the bridge tonight. I've been watching you walk home since you were young. Remember when I saw you dodge that cat riding home? That's when I knew you were ready to race. Now I know you're ready to fight. Join me.
Marco realized he had been watching his father, too, always expecting to see him at the foot of the bridge. I fought for fascism. Now I'll fight for Italy.
Bravo.
His father smiled.
But you have to follow my orders. I'm in command.
Agreed. Marco raised his glass, and then had a heartbreaking thought. To Aldo.
His father hoisted a glass. To our Aldo.
Chapter 74. Marco. 10th of September, 1943. Marco stood with his father and the partisans in a basement in Testaccio, a neighborhood south of central Rome. The Nazis ran the march toward the city. News of their imminent invasion had spread overnight. Shamefully, Marshal Badoglio and King Vittorio Emanuele III had fled the capital for Brindisi, out of harm's way. Badoglio hadn't even left behind a battle plan to defend the city. The Italian army was on its own, with only partisans for support. Here, Marco. His father handed him an M91 Carcano carbine long gun. Its heft weighed in Marco's hand, and he felt the gravity of their mission. He had fired rifles in Balilla, but never faced a live enemy. His father scanned the men with a steady gaze.
Any questions before we go?
Beppe, how many volunteers are there?
One of the partisans asked.
Several thousand deployed throughout the city.
How many are with us?
Perhaps 1,000.
Which of our army divisions will we be fighting with?
With us in the south are the Piacenza and Granatieri di Sardegna divisions, As for the Nazis, we fight regular Wehrmacht and Fallschirmjäger, the paratroopers. Most of you know their reputation as elite line infantry. Our troops outnumber the Nazis significantly."
His father paused, scanned the men for more questions, then continued.
"Gentlemen, I'm not one for talk. Our mission is clear. Hold Porta San Paolo. Prevent the Nazis from passing through the gate into the city. Our infantry will be on the ground with heavy weaponry. We will fire from rooftops and houses. We have a battle plan. We will execute it. This fight could last all day. By its end, we will emerge victorious. We fight for freedom and our magnificent city. We will hold Rome. Viva l'Italia! Viva Roma!"
They all shouted in accord. Marco shouldered his gun, swallowing hard. The partisans left the house and jogged down the street. It was a lower middle-class neighborhood, comprised of the meatpacking district and nondescript stucco homes. No sound came from the homes or shops. Their shutters and metal grates remained closed. The residents waited for the battle to begin, as they knew the Nazis would attempt to enter the city here. Invaders had done so since the ancient days of Rome, as far back as the Visigoths. Marco jogged up the street, looking ahead. The Porta San Paolo, the Gate of St. Paul, was a massive brick edifice called the Castelletto, as it looked like a medieval castle with a crenellated top over a gatehouse flanked by large turrets. In the center was the arch of the gate, which led to a fork that offered two ways to enter Rome: Via Mammorata to the west and Viale della Piramide Cestia to the east. To the south, the major artery from Porta San Paolo was Via Ostiense, and that was where the Nazis were expected to attack. Next to the Porta San Paolo was the ancient Pyramid of Cestius, which was embedded in the Aurelian Wall, part of the earliest fortifications of the city. Its white marble glowed in the early morning light, and its apex impaled the rising sun. Marco could see the Italian army taking positions around the Porta San Paolo and the pyramid. Soldiers grouped in loose formation, checking their equipment. A fleet of Italian tanks and motorized assault vehicles stood in front of the Porta San Paolo, and one tank was stationed under the arch of the gate. Soldiers loaded a row of self-propelled guns, the Obice 100mm howitzers, held long guns in front of the gate, and set up tripods for machine guns along Via Ostiense.
"Marco, come,"
his father said, motioning.
Marco followed his father and his father's old buddy Arnaldo, another veteran. The three of them formed a group, and according to his father's plan, the other partisans broke into small units and fanned out among the houses. They began knocking on doors, asking the residents to let them use the windows and rooftops.
"Open the door,"
his father said, banging on a weathered door at the southernmost end of the block.
"No," called a shaky voice from within. "We don't want any trouble."
"We defend you and your family. Open up. It's your duty as an Italian."
The door opened, and they were admitted by an old woman, nervous and haggard. Marco's father persuaded her to let them use the house, told her to hide in the cellar, then led the way up to the roof